Good morning again, everybody. So let's see, just to catch up, those of you who are joining today, I know there are a few. We've been contemplating Zen stories. And so I've been experimenting with different ways of doing this, ways that would be more practical for our ordinary everyday lives as we live them now. Some way that we can really get some good out of these stories, because they're wonderful stories and they carry, you know, deep teachings. So that's what we're that's what we're trying to do. So it's an experiment, and so far, the people that I heard from yesterday told me that it worked okay. And I was trying to think, I think this is the first time I've tried this experiment in a place with an audience that was not used to Zen practice, particularly. So it's very good to know that even with people who are not used to Zen practice, although, of course, used to Buddhist practice, the experiment worked okay. But that was yesterday. We don't know if it'll work today. But it seemed to work okay yesterday. So yesterday I gave a little introduction to the Zen literature, how it came to be and how it's been used in the past and so on and so on. But I won't do that today. But I will mention something today that I didn't talk about yesterday, a small but interesting and important fact, I think, is that probably all of you are familiar with the word koan, which is what they call the Zen stories. They call them koan. And koan is now an English word. You'll find it in an English dictionary. Like Dharma, it's an English word now. But you won't find the actual history of the word in Chinese, gong'an, in Japanese, koan. The word actually means public case. In the sense of a legal case that you could search out in the public record. And the reason why they called the Zen stories public cases was because it's just analogous to a legal case, because a law gets passed, right? And the law is this general abstract principle that is meant to apply in individual lives. But, as all lawyers know, exactly how that law applies in an individual case is often hard to discern. So sometimes somebody says, I think this law should not be applied in this way, and then they take it to court, you know, and then the courts determine, is this particular case in accord with the law or not? Because the law seems to be clear, but when you bring it down to cases, right, it becomes dubious. Well, that's exactly the idea with these stories, that, and this is how we need to make use of them. The Dharma, as an abstract law, and Dharma means law, right? The word Dharma means law. The Dharma, as an abstract law, is certainly true, but how does it actually apply in this case? In this case, in this case, in your case, in your particular case, in your particular life, how does the Dharma actually apply? And it's not always 100% clear, right? So these cases are supposed to be like precedents that show you how it applies in these particular cases. These are stories about particular people in their particular lives, trying to understand what these Dharma principles actually mean for their lives. And we're meant to use these cases as exemplars so that we can understand our own particular case. There's a very strong emphasis in Zen practice on making the Dharma personal, making it your own, not an abstract Buddhism outside there, but your life. And so you're meant to contemplate these stories and make them as if they're about you, as if they're actually your life. So that's the spirit in which we're making this experiment and this investigation, is that how is it your life, not some external Dharma, but Dharma that actually appears right in the middle of your life, as your life really is, not as you hope it would be or something like that, as your life really is. So we have a process, a methodology that we've been experimenting with. I made this up. And it consists of the following steps, five steps. And this is what we were doing yesterday. We took two different stories yesterday and we ran it through this process to see what would happen. Of course, this is a bit quick and artificial, because you could repeat the same process again and again and again, and variations of the process, because the process is not meant to be an eternal process. It's just one way of doing this, and you could make use of it in your own life in various ways. But you might take up a story for years. We're taking it up for an hour, so. But it's just to get a taste. So here's the process, and this is what we're going to do now. First, I read you the story, as if it were a bedtime story. I just read you the story, and the stories are quite brief. And then we spend about 10 minutes meditating on the story. And in order to do that, as you're sitting and quieting your mind, I drop into the calm pond of your mind a few phrases from the story that you can breathe with and sit with. And the idea is not to think about them or speculate about them, but just let them drop right down into your belly and see what happens. So in that way, we'll meditate with the stories just for maybe 10, 15 minutes at the most. And then the third step is that I'll give a short talk on the story. And then the fourth step is that we'll then spend some time contemplating the story, which means either sitting some more if you want to sit some more, writing in your journal, looking at the sky, wandering around the room, whatever you want to do in that period of time, while you're staying with the story in your belly, paying attention to what arises in your mind, but not necessarily thinking through the story. This is not, somebody said that I was telling people not to think. Well, good luck with that. I'm not telling people not to think, but I'm saying, instead of imagining that you're thinking through the story, imagine that you're feeling through with your whole body the story. And then, yes, if you have thoughts, you notice the thoughts, you're aware of them and you appreciate them, but you don't think, that's how I'm going to penetrate this story. You just notice those thoughts. So that's the fourth step. And then the fifth step, we tried different ways of doing this yesterday. The fifth step is that we come together and we express ourselves, because this is a very important part of contemplating Zen stories, is that you express your understanding to another person. It's a very highly valued practice in Zen, your expression. So that's the last step. Okay, so that's a review for everybody who was here yesterday, and a little orientation for those of you who weren't. And I've been using stories from the Book of Serenity, which is a collection of 100 Zen stories made in the 12th century, I think, by a Chinese Zen person. It's been translated into English under that title, The Book of Serenity by Thomas Cleary. This is the 54th story from the Book of Serenity. And the title of the story is Yunyan's Great Compassion. This is the same Yunyan that we talked about yesterday, who was sweeping the ground. This is the same person. And the other character in the story, Dawu, is also the same person that was in the story yesterday. These two characters reappear in this story. Yunyan asked Dawu, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Dawu said, it's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. Yunyan said, I understand. Dawu said, how do you understand? And Yunyan said, all over the body is hands and eyes. Dawu said, you said a lot there, but you only got 80%. And Yunyan said, what about you, elder brother? And Dawu said, the whole body is nothing but hands and eyes. So that's our story. So let's sit with that for a few minutes. What is compassion? What is compassion? reaching back for your pillow at night. Reaching back in the dark. Nothing but hands and eyes. The whole body, nothing but hands and eyes. there's a background story to Avalokiteshvara's hands and eyes. In Chinese, Avalokiteshvara became a really, really important bodhisattva, almost like a cult deity. And in Sanskrit, Avalokiteshvara is a male figure, but in Chinese Buddhism, she became a female figure, sometimes called Kanon, and sometimes called Kanzeon, and sometimes called Kanjizai. And all those names translate into either the one who listens to the cries of the world, or the one who sees the suffering of the world. So she is the bodhisattva of compassion who pays attention and cares about every suffering in the world. And the story goes that she was practicing like this, just filling her heart and her ears with the sounds of the suffering of the world, and one day it became too much for her and her head exploded. Kaboom! Her head just completely exploded. And then appearing in the place of her exploded head were an infinity of heads, one on top of the other, and simultaneously appearing an infinity of arms. And in each hand was an eye. So the eye would see the suffering and the need, and the hand would be able to help. So then her problem was solved, because now she had infinite heads and infinite hands and eyes. And sometimes you can see statues of Guanyin that are like that, with infinite hands. Not infinite, but numerous arms with an eye in each palm of the hand and numerous heads stacked on top of one another. Not always. Usually it's just a statue of a lovely, compassionate woman, often with a vase of water or flower or something, but sometimes many heads, many arms. In the Book of Serenity, Wansong writes an introduction to this story. The introduction says, "Crystal clear on all sides, open and unobstructed in all directions, emanating light and making the earth tremble in all places, subtly exercising spiritual powers all the time." All the time. "Tell me, how is this manifested?" And then the story answers that question. And Wansong also has a lengthy commentary, the first sentence of which is, "Li Ao asked Ehu, 'What does the great compassionate one use 1,000 hands and eyes for?' And Ehu said, 'What does the emperor use public officials for?'" So Zen practice is basically only about compassion. That's really the, as a Mahayana school, it's really its mission and its underlying purpose is only compassion. But you could miss this. You know, if you go to a Zen place, you might not notice this. People think Zen might be about transcendental enlightenment. It might be about self-exploration or developing calmness or maybe developing concentration and strength of mind. They might think it's about, you know, Japanese forms or aesthetic values. But all of that is actually in the service of compassion. It's all a series of devices for the purpose of opening the heart to a profound compassion, just like all Mahayana schools. But in all Mahayana Buddhist schools, compassion always goes along with wisdom. Compassion and wisdom are the same thing, but we use two different words and we speak about them differently conceptually so that we can understand the real meaning of compassion. In Mahayana Buddhism, wisdom means very specifically the wisdom that understands the emptiness of all phenomena, that everything arises and passes away and nothing has any real boundary. The separation between things is conceptual, not actual. And so things arise and pass away constantly in constant identity with each other. There's really no me and no you. There's just us arising together in a moment of time, passing away in a moment of time. And that already is compassion. That's the grounding of compassion and the root of compassion and the truth that underlies compassion. So seeing this truth experientially, seeing that really my individuality, my individual problems and needs and desires is nothing other than an expression of life's flow. And life's flow is always all-inclusive. And includes, at all points, passing away. Because life isn't anything. Life comes and goes every moment, right? Moment after moment. We think death comes at the end of our life, but it doesn't. It comes every minute of our life as we're losing our life moment by moment by moment. And everything is arising and passing away that way. And when we really appreciate that, we understand how precious life is, how brilliant it is, and we understand that we might as well say, instead of life, we might as well say love, because nothing would be here, right, without this mysterious loving force that flows on through me and through you and through every living thing. So, in other words, wisdom and compassion is really the same thing. And the real root of compassion is not our pity and our separation. It's our radically identifying connection. So this means the equation is something like emptiness equals being or life, which is actually not life, but a hyphenated word, life and death, which equals love, which equals compassion, which equals suffering. All these things are really one thing that appear differently to us at different times. But when we truly appreciate the Buddha's teaching, we can see in each one every other one. So in Zen, this story is actually the most important and one of the few Zen stories that speaks directly about compassion. Because in Zen mostly, compassion teachings are implicit. They're kind of understood and not necessarily explicitly discussed. They go along with the transmission of the tradition. In Tibetan Buddhist schools, there are a lot of explicit teachings about compassion. There's a term used in Zen also called bodhicitta, which means the thought, the sudden insight into awakening, which marks the actual beginning of the path for any individual, all of a sudden, somehow. And maybe it doesn't look like it's all of a sudden, maybe it looks like it's gradually, but all of a sudden, you realize, I can't keep on going the way I've been going. That's not a life. That life really is awakening. And the only way to awaken is to awaken into love and compassion. Because awakening for me, that I would awaken, and everybody else, the poor schlemiels, they're stuck back there in their ignorance, is an impossibility. It's like an oxymoron. It can't be. And you know, the Zen story has its own version of the Buddha's enlightenment story. And if you read it in the Zen books, it says, Buddha awakens, and in the moment of awakening, exclaims, "Ah, this is great. I and all sentient beings in this moment are all equally liberated now. Not like me and what's wrong with them, but if I understand myself, how else do I understand it other than within my heart, all sentient beings are now liberated in this moment." But we don't really understand all that, right? As Westerners, we get you know what it says in the books, but we don't really get the whole of the tradition. So that's why I have felt like we have to borrow, as Zen people, we have to borrow from the explicit Tibetan teachings, Indo-Tibetan really, on developing compassion, which is why I wrote my book, Training in Compassion. I meant it as a kind of necessary element in the Western Zen curriculum so that we could understand better that our practice is all about compassion. But this story expresses beautifully the true Zen spirit of compassion. It's telling us that compassion is a natural function of life. It's as natural as being alive, as natural as living. Living is compassion. Dogen says somewhere, to accept a body and give up a body, these are supreme acts of compassion. It's a beautiful thought, right? When you think about it, you know, why would any of us be born? So much trouble, you know, being alive. I can't get over it, how much trouble it is, you know. Isn't it? It's nothing but maintenance. Fix this, clean that, that's it. It would be so much easier not to have been born. But we all do it. Isn't it wonderful? We're all willing to take up this burden. Why do we do it? For one another. We do it for one another. And then, at the end of our lives, to make room for the next people, we all graciously, compassionately agree to die. So far, every human being has made this agreement. They've said, okay. I mean, what a compassionate act, right? I'm going, you come on, I'm leaving and leaving the space for you. Give your whole life to make space for someone else. What a compassionate act, right? And we all do it without even knowing we're doing it. So being born and dying are natural acts of compassion, and everything that happens in between is compassion. It's just as natural and as unthinking as reaching back for your pillow in the night. You don't even know what you're doing, and yet you somehow do it. You do it anyway. When you're able to simply and fully, with full honesty and truth, live your life without all the extra burdens and confusion that we put on top of our basic life, just live it honestly and truly, you realize this is just compassion. It's never been anything but compassion. The whole body is nothing but hands and eyes. Everything that furthers any form of life is compassion. There's nothing but hands and eyes. There's no difference between what we think of compassion and any other form of living. It's all compassion. Of course, we do what we call acts of compassion. You know, we help, we offer support, we offer kindness, we offer love. Because our practice moves us to do so. We can't not do that. That's the human heart. The human heart will respond with sympathy to any creature in need. But when we do that, we don't think of it as something special. Wow, I'm so compassionate. I'm compassionate today. I wasn't compassionate yesterday. No, we just think it's a natural, normal thing to do. It's not a big deal. And if we see everything as compassion, even taking care of ourselves, right? And one of the points in the Lojong book that I make is that you cannot be compassionate toward others if you're also not compassionate toward yourself. The idea of trashing yourself so that you can be compassionate to others really doesn't make sense. You couldn't really truly be compassionate to others unless you take care of yourself for others, right? This precious life never did belong to you in the first place. So you really have to take good care of it for others. It's your duty, right? That means physically, psychologically, spiritually, in every way. Take care of yourself with lots of loving kindness and compassion for others so that you can offer your life to others. So, what I'm saying is not complicated, esoteric, easy to say, easy to understand, easy even to appreciate and aspire to, less easy to live every single day, right? So that's why we have to contemplate this story, we have to make this story, we have to really see that we don't need the word compassion, right? We don't need to add the label compassion on top of it. We need to feel our everyday living, all of our words and deeds, all of our relationships, as essentially being act of compassion. Even our own suffering, even our own self-manufactured suffering, at its root is compassion. Can we feel it like that? Can we live it like that? So let's take the next 15 minutes or so to contemplate this story. And I'll offer you one further suggestion. As you're moving around and staying with the story, aware of thinking coming and going, but not using the thinking as your methodology, think through the story, feel through. You could repeat to yourself once in a while the phrase, this life. That would be good. Isn't that a good one? This life. Just notice, this life. Not my life. It's already, I'm worried. You know, my life, oh no. This life. This life. This life of standing, this life of walking, this life of drinking tea, this life. What is this life?